from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It is the 30th day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Bruce Bostard will join us from the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company in Ludlow, Illinois, a bit later in the program to take a look at the cash grain market. And we'll hear from Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey, about the agricultural weather forecast. And it all happens right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby September wheat at $6.27.5, and the settlement price in the wheat pit actually at 661.5, up 34 cents for the day. December at 693.75, up 34.25, and the March at 713.5, up 30.5. The hard red September at 674.5, up 28.25. Wheat leading everything else higher. September corn futures up 13.5, a 392.75 settlement price. December at 406.75 for the harvest month in the corn, 13 cents higher. March at 418.75, up 12.25. And the May at 425.5, 11.5 cents higher. July futures $4.32, up 11.25. August soybean futures $10.52.5, 25.75 higher. September 10.12, up 19.25. November beans at $10.05, 17 cents rather higher. And January futures at $10.11, up 15.5. Next year's July at $10.19. up 13 cents in the soybean pit. Soybean meal futures at 310.90, up 5.50. Soybean oil at 39.83, up 56 on the afternoon. August live cattle futures 92.65, or 80 cents higher on the day. August feeders at 113.72.5, finished unchanged. The September were down 7.5 at 114.20, but the Octobers were up 37.5 at 115.7.5. And the lean hog futures finished the August contract at $85.82.5. Settlement price there, up 97.5 cents for 100 pounds. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media in Urbana-Champaign. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, September contract, $78.84 a barrel, 48 cents higher. The fuel ethanol at $1.70.2, up 3.6 cents for the day. Natural gas at $4.91.3, 8.6 cents higher. Diesel fuel or heating oil at $2.04.2, up 0.5 cent. And the gold futures on the afternoon at $1,181.70 an ounce. A settlement price, $13.30 higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, just about 23 points lower at 10,444. And the U.S. dollar now down 0.08 at 81.55 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like and across the Midwest and the nation. According to Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated, out of Kansas City, Mr. Lerner says we'll have one more day of seasonable temperatures, and then it'll get warmer. Temperatures will be near to above a normal and average through the next 10 days, with daily highs in the 80s and the lows in the upper 80s, rather, in the lower 90s, most common. A few warmer readings will occur periodically in the south. Rain frequency will continue to be high, but its intensity will continue to diminish in time. Net drying will become more common, says Mr. Lerner, over the next 2 weeks, even though showers and thunderstorms will occur periodically. Subsoil moisture should remain supportive for normal crop development, while some topsoil firms. Crop stress will be far from significant in the south and the delta, where much of that warm temperature is expected to be. There'll be a few days with restricted rain over the next 7 days in that area. A more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
On this Friday afternoon, time to check the agricultural futures markets. On the line with us from his Lafayette, Indiana office at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting is Mr. Wheat himself, Mike Zuzalo. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hello, Todd. Happy Friday to you.
Oh, happy Friday, dude. It's still leading. The last time I talked, it was leading last week, and here you go. Giddy up one more time. What do you think?
It's led too long and too far at this point, I think, Todd. I think at this stage of the game, and I'm not trying to call a high because, you know, you don't want to do that in a market with such strong momentum and sentiment, but I feel like earlier in the year when we had such a bearish trade psychology in wheat, the trade and the funds especially did it so much to the downside, too much to the downside, that we're moving into the opposite direction where they're going too much to the upside. And really there's nothing that can stop them at this point unless you get a technical sell signal before the August 12th report, because they're trying, I think, to factor in as much possible bullishness on the global wheat as they possibly can, so that they don't get any bullish surprises when August 12th rolls around. But that's still quite a few days and trading days away.
I know you take a thoughtful look oftentimes at the fundamental picture. So tell me about wheat across the planet. Where is it grown? How much is grown? Where do the export markets come from? And why has this made such a difference at this point?
Well, this past year, the reason why the wheat had such a negative bias goes back to the exports, and where the export market was competing with the United States so seriously was in Europe, was in the Black Sea, in the Ukraine, and the former Soviet Union, those same areas that they have tremendous problems right now. But like the International Grains Council's update on the global wheat production, which came in at 651 million tons, this week, I'm running a 645 million ton production number, Todd, and even with those kinds of cuts, you're still looking at a stocks-to-use ratio of about 25%. And at 25% stocks-to-use ratio, yes, you're historically on the tight side, but you're not anywhere problematic in terms of being able to supply the world with wheat. In fact, IGC made the point that at a 651 million ton crop, it's still the third largest on record. And so I think that's where the fundamentals line out. But clearly the fact that Argentina is having some problems with getting their wheat planted, and these issues in the former Soviet Union, now Germany is being talked about as having an 8 to 9% deficit versus last year in production. Those are all markets that we usually compete with. Australia's in pretty good shape from what it seems like, and India's monsoon really came on strong this past week. So there were some friendly production things that came out, and which would normally, I think, be bearish to the market. But Tuesday we saw a big shift, and a big shift in psychology by the funds. They came back into the risky assets, and like they've done this past month and a half, they really bought into the wheat hard.
Okay, so let's think about this historically. In the middle of the last decade, somewhere in the middle of the 06, 07, 08, I don't recall quite when, we were short of wheat supply. Is that right on the planet?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we came out of 08 with about 165 million tons. I think we had dropped back into the 130s and 140s back in 06, 07. But essentially, we came out in 08 back up around 165 million tons. That's where we might be heading back towards here with the August 12th report. So we are on the tight side.
So we're on the tight side. We're in familiar territory there. We had a big run that came along with the run in the financial markets and the oil at that point. How does this differ today than that time frame?
Well, I think simply put, I think the economic situation in a lot of these countries is what's different. We have a lot more supplies that can be met with the demand, and I think that the Europeans, even the Europeans themselves, are saying the Russian problems will probably not affect their prices that much. Even if Russia would halt their grain exports, the amount that they sell out to the market in the world traditionally is not that much. Yes, the last couple of years it's been extremely big, and that's what's kept our supplies tight. So I guess the most friendly thing that I can say about the wheat right now is that we should be able to garner more of the world demand by increased exports. But by the same token, we've got $7 wheat at the Gulf right now for soft red wheat if you're looking at an October bid. And if you're looking at getting something in the fall, you're looking at $7 already at the Gulf. And so I think a lot of that, again, has been priced in fundamentally. In fact, I saw where the soft red wheat bids fell about 15 cents yesterday in terms of the basis at the Gulf, trying to counter the rally that we've been seeing in the futures.
Okay, and then one complicating factor, and I don't know how complicating or what difference it makes at this point, but the delivery system, of course, has been changed to some extent. And is that making any difference at this point?
I think it is from a standpoint of holding more wheat in the bins, and that's naturally a more negative factor. In fact, the midweek updates from the Southern Plains, Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas panhandle elevators were all reporting adequate supplies of wheat and still, you know, stocked pretty much to the brim. I think the big thing that the wheat is also trying to do at this stage of the game, it makes sense seasonally if you look at a calendar. I think we're trying to buy a lot of new crop acres right now because a month from now, the producers are going to either be harvesting corn and planting wheat. They're going to have a tough time changing their acreage mix, you know, a month and a half from now. So it strikes me that maybe by this July wheat, both in Kansas City and Chicago, both going over $7, we're trying to buy those acres right now. And a month from now, we'll either have done it or not done it. So the timing aspect of this rally is darn near perfect because we came into it so negatively fund-wise, and the calendar is saying get the new crop acres bought. We had a lot of bonds that were bought as safe havens. We sold out of the bonds. We've got an 11-week high in the euro against the dollar. That's factored in. That was factoring into the earlier year major negativity by the funds in terms of the wheat because of the dollar euro. We've also got an 8-month high in the yen against the dollar. So I think all these things kind of came together in what I would say is almost a perfect storm for a bullish momentum move like we're seeing here.
Okay, one final question on wheat, and then we still have plenty of time to talk corn and beans
Sure. For
the day. If you make the decision to sow wheat this fall, first, would you make that decision? Then secondly, if you do that on these fundamentals, would you make the sale today too?
Yeah, I would make the decision to plant more wheat. I think we will have a good export market for the marketing year 2010, 2011, or the rest of it. I would, based upon clients and agronomists that I talked to, I'm certainly no agronomist, but it sure sounded like in soft red country, if you put fungicide down, it really made a big difference both last year and this year. So I would really look at spending the extra money per acre on fungicide if you're going to put more wheat in. And, yes, I would sell 25 to 30% of new crop wheat at these prices.
Okay, so now let's say we've got the extra wheat acres. That means we have to battle it out for corn and soybeans to some extent. And we, at this point, are looking at heat, probably. I don't know whether we're looking at stress in terms of rainfall. The suggestion we'll hear a bit later in the program from the state climatologist is probably not. He thinks that maybe the next month, August, will be warmer, but it's likely to follow suit and be just as wet as July and June were. So what do you do there?
As far as the corn market?
Yep.
I think the big thing with the corn market is if you look at the weekly closes, we had the wheat up about 11%, corn up about just under 6% in these futures, no beans up only about 2.5%. So clearly the corn was following the wheat this week, and the Chicago trade is still fairly bearish, the corn. From my perspective, Todd, it seems like to me, based upon client surveys that I'm getting back for ahead of this August report, they're not seeing a lot of good fill. They're seeing denting corn already. The tips are not filling out in a lot of cases. Even areas that have had good rains, we're not seeing the big, big yields that I think maybe Chicago thinks we're going to see. So I think what's going to happen here is that the trade is going to get more bullish on beans because of this heat in the Delta, and corn's going to be more of a follower with the wheat and the beans like it was maybe 2-3 months ago. If there were going to be a bullish surprise somewhere down the road, maybe not in the August report, but maybe in the September report, once we get into the fields, I think that's where it's going to be in the corn. So I'm more hesitant to recommend to clients to sell cash corn off the combine right now because basis is mostly wider in most areas that the listening audience is in, and because of some of these surveys I'm getting back would make me think, well, once we get started earlier than normal because we are denting, maybe the worst basis is going to come early, and then maybe we have a cash-led turnaround in the corn market.
Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a good weekend, sir.
And you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In today's agricultural news, Senate Republicans stood against Democrats Thursday by voting against a motion to limit debate on a subtle amendment to the small business bill. Republicans complained that they were not given a fair chance to get votes on five amendments, including one on the estate tax. Still, Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell says his team's getting closer. He predicted a chance of significant progress very soon on the estate tax. But Majority Leader Harry Reid remains frustrated. Reid accused the Republicans of not wanting an agreement. Democrats and President Obama continue to urge the Senate to act quickly. The measure pending before the Senate would create a $30 billion small business lending fund, extend $12 billion in tax breaks, and enhance federal programs designed to help small businesses. Senators Chambliss and Brownback are questioning the USDA's budget. Senate Ag Committee Ranking Member Saxby Chambliss and Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Agriculture Ranking Member Sam Brownback wrote a letter to Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack Wednesday, urging USDA to take deficit reduction seriously. The senators say they openly question why the United States Department of Agriculture would require flexibility from the Office of Management and Budget to cut mandatory farm safety net programs to meet discretionary funding reductions. They say honest budgeting requires discretionary savings come from reductions to discretionary programs. And they believe the president's proposed budget for the 2012 fiscal year should be based on honest budgeting. In their letter, Chambliss and Brownback note discretionary and mandatory programs in regard to USDA's budget increased 7 and 20% respectively over the previous two fiscal years. Well, the smaller Canadian crop is a factor. Export sales of U.S. hard red spring wheat through the first 6 weeks of this marketing year are 26% higher than last year. North Dakota Wheat Commission Marketing Director Jim Peterson says total sales stand at 60 million bushels, with sales to Asia, the largest spring wheat export destination, up by 25%.
For spring wheat, the big issue is the smaller crop in Canada. They and us, you know, compete for the higher quality, higher protein markets, and so that's going to give us a little bit of advantage. And a lot of it's going to be keyed on, you know, what is the final protein in our crop this year.
The government's most recent forecast has U.S. spring wheat exports this year up 16% from last. Peterson says Durham exports are doing well, too. Durham sales so far this year are up nearly 50% compared to the same time a year ago. And Growth Energy's CEO Tom Bias says yesterday's editorial titled "Energy Subsidies Good and Bad" in the New York Times misrepresents the company's proposal to open the U.S. transportation fuels market and fails to acknowledge the technological advancements that have made ethanol production cleaner and more efficient. Bias says the editorial does not correctly signify Growth Energy's Fueling Freedom Plan, which would redirect the current blender's tax credit to support a build-out of the distribution infrastructure to give Americans what he calls a true choice of fuels at the pump. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Listening to the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon, please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. Well, Michelle Rook, farm broadcaster from WNAX in Yankton, South Dakota, has been traveling through Mexico with the members of the United Soybean Board. She says those soybean farmers are seeing for themselves the growing market for a product in Latin America. This week, 10 farmers have been touring farms and processing facilities in the state of Jalisco, Mexico. United Soybean Board Director Vicky Coughlin says Mexico is the number two market for U.S. soybean meal, and it's been evident while touring some of the large livestock operations in that region.
Well, number one, it's close to us. And that's huge when we see the transportation costs that we're all dealing with. I mean, we can all relate to how expensive it is to transport any commodity, and it's right next to us. And there's an extremely high usage and demand for soy down here. We heard about the school lunch programs down here, how they're incorporating soy in the diets of the children.
Coughlin says the potential for future growth of U.S. soybean exports to Mexico is also obvious.
It certainly is a growing market. And from everything that we see, the economy down here is strong, and that's an indication that animal agriculture is going to grow, and the diets are going to also change for the population.
Ann Coughlin says the Mexican livestock producer seems to prefer U.S. soybean meal to product that's originated in their own country, in part due to price and quality.
The one thing that we heard a number of times when we were on the tours down here in Guadalajara was the quality of U.S. soybeans. I think that just about every place that we visited made that statement. And while I like to hear that as a producer, I like to hear it even more when they actually, you can see that they mean it.
Coughlin is just one of the soybean farmers on the See for Yourself tour put on by the United Soybean Board in Jalisco, Mexico. Our audio from Vicki Coughlin and the story were provided and written by Michelle Rook of WNEX. She's a farm broadcaster in Yankton, South Dakota.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It is a Friday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural cash grain market. On the phone line with us, Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company's 10 elevators in Central and East Central Illinois. Joins us from the Ludlow office. Good afternoon to you, Bruce. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Farmers like the little pop in the marketplace?
It was not a bad way to close out the month. There was some suspicion going in that we might see the funds being aggressive buyers to dress up their closes and make the month end look good for the purchasing that they've done over the last couple of weeks, and they sure did that with a vengeance today.
And they did that with a vengeance. Was there any corn left out there for you to purchase?
We were buying some, and I was just looking at purchases, and there was even some old crop that came out of the woodwork today. Not a huge amount, but we bought some old crop, some ketchup buying there. Beans, not surprisingly, most all the bean purchases were new crop today.
Do we need to worry still about the condition of the old crop that's coming in? What's it look like from your perspective?
Damaged.
That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much what's coming in, most of it's got some damage in it, and it's just relative varying amounts.
Yeah, varying amounts. You got a relative doc that you're on average.
I would hate to guess. Everything's coming in with a discount on it. You know, we saw the Illinois River go a couple weeks ago. Some places to not taking anything over 5% damage. I think the St. Louis market's like max 10, so it's a problem everywhere.
You think the market can hang on and stay higher as we move through the month of August now?
I think that we've got... The bets are made. We've got a buy-the-dip type of attitude. There's enough of an unknown out here in this Black Sea wheat. I mean, that whether it's Kazakhstan or Ukraine or Russia, there's been enough of that wheat that has been a competitor with corn as a feed grain that if we're going to chop a good chunk of that crop off, that could push some business to us.
And your bids for the day?
We are at 373 on nearby corn, 375 on new crop. Soybeans are 1050 and 980.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report to take a look at the cash grain market back in 2 minutes when we'll talk with Jim Angel, state climatologist, about the agricultural weather forecast.
It's National Cheesecake Day. It's also St. Abdon's Day, patron of barrel makers. The Romans used barrels as early as the 3rd century AD. By the mid-20th century, barrels had largely lost their appeal, except for the aging of spirits, including wine and whiskey. On this day in agricultural history in 1739, Caspar Wiskar founded the first successful large-scale glass factory in the U.S. Much of his trade was with the production of wine bottles. In 1838, it supposedly rained frogs in London. In 1849, Jacob Perkins died. Perkins was issued the first U.S. patent for a refrigerating machine. It used sulfuric ether compression. Perkins also produced the first nails, which were both cut and headed by machine in America. He also patented a hot air furnace. In 1898, cornflakes were invented by William Kellogg, 4 years after he and his brother John Harvey accidentally invented a flaked cereal process based on wheat. In 1906, the brothers founded the Battle Creek Toasted Cornflake Company, which is known today as Kellogg's. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Friday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Jim Angel, state climatologist, joins us from the Illinois State Water Survey right here in Urbana-Champaign. Thank you, Mr. Angel, for being with us. Tell me about the weekend weather first.
Yeah, well, you know, Todd, it looks like this weekend will actually be a little nicer. Highs will be in the mid-80s and lows in the 60s. A little less humidity than we experienced earlier this week. There's maybe a chance of rain on tonight and a little bit chance tomorrow on Saturday. But overall, I think it's going to be a pretty nice weekend. Then by Monday, the warm, humid air is going to return, and it's going to be back in the upper 80s, low 90s, and very muggy again.
Yeah, those muggy conditions are not really great for humans, but not too bad, I suppose, for crops across the Midwest. When you look at Illinois, some of the parts, other parts of the Midwest, can you tell me, there are some places that seem to be suffering just a bit, not, I suppose, drought stress exactly, but they are a little drier than you might have thought at this time.
That's right. If you look at, far southern Illinois, south of I-64, has really been on the dry side. And I think everybody's attention is kind of focused on the heavy rains in western Illinois, but southern Illinois, there's many areas that only got about 1 or 6 to 3 inches of rain in July here. So they're on the dry side, and that's part of a large area of dryness. It's kind of in the Missouri Boot Heel area, so we're kind of connected up with that.
Any chance of rainfall there? And then what happens as we get into next week across the state?
Well, the next chance of rain is about Tuesday, and that's going to be fairly widespread, but probably not too heavy rains at this point in the forecast. So southern Illinois has a shot at that. And if you look at the 6 to 10 day and 8 to 14 day, the National Weather Service has us as in an area of increased temperatures and above average rainfall. So we have some pretty good shots of rainfall coming up in the next couple of weeks here.
July is a month for corn. August is a month for soybeans. Preview that and weather conditions, please, if you could.
Yeah, the National Weather Service forecast for August is for an increased chance of above normal temperatures, and they're fairly neutral on the precipitation. But, you know, if we kind of go by the pattern so far this summer, June was wet and warm. July was wet and warm. So it would not surprise me at all if August turned out to be both wet and warm as well.
How unusual is it to have 3 months like that in a row in the summertime in the state of Illinois?
Well, you know, the last 2 years it was unheard of. You know, we were practically freezing to death last year. But, there's summers in the past that's actually not that unusual. I mean, we're not, like, setting records or anything. We've just been running a little on the warm side. So that's not too bad.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey right here in Urbana-Champaign. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Stay with us if you can for the farming world this afternoon. If not, you can always hear it online at willag.org. That's willag.org. You have a good afternoon.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, in today with Jim Hires. He's the Executive Director of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, located in Urbana. Thanks so much, Mr. Hires, for being with us. First, I suppose that we should tell folks that you and I have a working relationship because I sat on the board at the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
Yes, you do. You're one of our 14 board members.
And speaking of 14, which 14 counties do we cover, or at least a broad range regionally anyway?
Well, we go all the way from Iroquois County in the north and Ford County all the way down to Clay County on the eastern side of the state. There are 14 counties that we cover. There are 8 food banks in the state of Illinois, and we've divided the state up in geographic regions. So that's our general area, about a little over 8,000 square miles.
And how many people use the services or the food bank? And maybe you ought to explain what the difference between a food bank and a food pantry is.
Well, a food bank is, in a simple explanation, is we're the people who put the food in food pantries, the soup in soup kitchens, and the snack in the snack programs. And in our particular 14 counties, approximately 103,000 different individuals use the service on an annual basis, and that boils down between 45 and 50,000 people a month to visit the food pantries, and then we count meals separately from that.
And so how many meals do you think are being served?
There are about 120,000 meals per month served in the 14 counties.
That's a lot.
Those are in shelters and soup kitchens.
That's a number of meals. Can you tell me about food insecurity and what that means in your business?
Food insecurities are individuals who at any given time have to make a decision about either having another activity, paying a bill, paying a medical bill, utility bill, car payment, transportation, and buying food. Other definition is that on any given time, they may not know if they're going to have enough food to last for the next day or so for themselves or their family.
These are important things and you operate the food bank as a business, so they're sort of important things to know to get an idea of how much you need to have in the warehouse. And maybe you can talk about the warehouse and the storage and food collection and fundraising and those sorts of things as well.
Well, our warehouse is a 40,000 square foot warehouse located in Urbana. We've had this particular warehouse since 2004, I'm sorry. And before that, we were located in a much smaller facility near downtown Urbana, Illinois. Our warehouse is normally stocked between 600 and 1,000 and a million pounds of food at any given time, because we turn our warehouse over about 7.5 times a year. And we'd like to have a month's supply in the warehouse at any given time. It'd be cool if we had a little bit more, then that's about 600,000 pounds on a regular basis we'd like to have in inventory in case something would happen in terms of the supply chain, and we would be able to still service our pantries and soup kitchens. That food comes from a variety of sources, as you well know, as we've talked about in other previous interviews, but it is primarily comes from three places: donated food, and we'll talk about donated as we discuss where food comes from, purchased food, and then USDA commodities.
Well, let's start with the donated food. Where does it come from?
Our donated food comes primarily from manufacturers, wholesalers, and large distributors of food. People do conduct food drives for us, and they're a very, very important aspect of what we do to get the message out about hunger. But the primary source for donated food are those manufacturers and distributors. Manufacturers such as Kraft and Nabisco, ConAgra, Campbell Soup, Kellogg's, General Mills, those type of companies. And then we belong to the network of 206 food banks around the country, and we have a system where we go online almost a daily basis, and we move food around the country, and that food is donated from various areas where they have surpluses, and we have access to that as well. In addition to that, we use locally donated food through pickups with our all of our Walmarts, Sam's, other grocery stores such as Snooks, County Market, Target, and then through a major wholesale produce company called W. Newell, which we get a great deal of produce from. That's the donated side.
Yeah, on the donated side, so tell me a bit about what has happened over the last 10 years as the companies, the crafts of the world, the ConAgras of the world have gotten better at their job. And the donated food is often things that are perfectly fine food, but they're off weight. Packaging is wrong. What's happened in the last 10 years that's changed the amount of donated food that comes from these types of companies?
Well, when you go to the grocery store, people scan a little card that they've been given to the major supermarket, and they tie that to sales, et cetera, et cetera. But primarily that's used for inventory control. Years ago, I always like to use Kraft as an example there, since they're local. If Kraft would manufacture 25 million cases, for example, of mac and cheese, with the hope of selling 25 million cases, now they know through those scanning devices just what stores can move, how they're moving it, and they do more online production or on-time production. So those excess quantities are not available. And most manufacturers have done that. And that's been a big, big, big change. The other thing is quality control in the manufacturing sector. If you were in the manufacturing business, your job would, one of your jobs would be to keep waste down to a minimum. And these companies have gotten much, much better at food handling, labeling, so they don't make the mistakes that you used to, that we used to be able to get. That's the biggest change.
Yeah, so that's the big change, and it meant that there is less that would be coming into the food bank.
Right, and it's not because those individual companies and organizations don't want to contribute. Is they're doing their job by being efficient and keeping their costs down. And so you can't get upset with the business model. That's what they're in business for. But that's made us have to be a little more creative.
We've had to be more creative. And one of the things that the Eastern Illinois Food Bank has tried to be creative about is the types of products that are in stock. You prefer to have, if you can get that, these types of products anyway, nutritionally, what you call nutritionally dense products. Why is that the case, and what do you aim to be able to get into the warehouse?
Well, when you look at food insecurity, most of the time people just don't have enough to eat. And I think that it's an important thing to remember that we have really two missions when we provide emergency food. One is to fill people up. And secondly is to try to provide food that is nutritionally dense, that is not just wasted calories. We can get a lot of carbohydrates. It's hard to get protein. Being meat and those kinds of things donated. And they're very, very expensive to purchase, so it's easier to purchase and to get donated less nutritious food than we could purchase. So we made a commitment, our board did, about 4 or 5 years ago to improve the quality of the food that we do send to our pantries. That has necessitated us having a vigorous purchase food program and raising funds to do that. But we also believe that it's important that the quality of food be there. It's a balance that we have to go through. And I tell my staff, I said, if we have to make a choice, we're going to feed people, but we're going to try to do it with nutritionally dense food when possible.
And how do you do that?
Primarily through our purchase program. We have a very aggressive purchase food program. It started about 11 years ago when the board at that time had foresight to know that we're going to have to make up where we can't get food through this process. And we have developed that into a very, very, very good business model where we can buy food on the wholesaler market very much like a grocer would buy it. And we pool our resources through the State Association, Feeding Illinois, and the other 8 food banks to buy in large quantities so that our costs are very minimal, because our food pantries do have to pay for the cost of that food so that we can stay in business, obviously.
And so what it all means is that, and maybe we can use pounds as opposed to dollars, but the food bank is capable of parlaying what would be the cost of 1 pound of food into about 10 pounds of food instead? Is that right?
If you give it as a dollar, we can parlay that into about $10 worth of food. And the retail value of food that we get is right now listed at about $1.50 a pound. That's the average kind of thing through a food bank. So we're able to parlay our dollar basically because of the interconnection and the networking with all the other food banks around the country.
We're talking with an audience primarily this afternoon of agriculturalists, probably some that raise both corn and soybeans, almost all of them, but also that might be producers of beef cattle or hogs or goats and sheep. They might also have vegetables on their farms. How might they go about donating to the food pantry, and what kinds of facilities do you have on hand that can help them with that? Do we have transportation? Or do we have the ability to do refrigerated and freezer products? What kinds of things might a producer be able to do with the food bank, and are there advantages for them? And I guess I suppose beyond feeling good, I'm thinking about tax advantages.
Well, let me start with those farmers who primarily raise commodity products such as corn and soybeans. We have a relationship with the Illinois Pork Producers Association. That relationship is through the Food Bank Association, now called Feeding Illinois. And they've been partners with us for about the last 3 years, along with the Illinois corn producers, to provide ground pork to the food banks around the state. And these are donated by operators. And then they're processed through various meat processors across the state who belong to an association of those groups, and that's paid for by the corn producers. So we now have a history with producers, and we're trying to obviously develop that further with the beef producers, and of course we do have one with the egg producers in the state as well. So even though farmers indicate I don't necessarily raise vegetables, there is a connection between the land and the people in Illinois, and we're very, very aware of that. Into the local production of fresh produce, we would prefer to have Illinois fresh produce all the time if we could get it in the quantities that we can get it. And to that end, we do work with local area farmers on doing pickups, and of course our Plant a Row program with Master Gardeners has been an active part of what we've done over the years. We pick up at the farmers market at the end of each Saturday anything that's left, and then of course we get produce through our affiliation with Produce Warehouse. And then we will buy produce through the Food Bank Association if we can get that at a good quantity. The Feeding Illinois commitment is to do as much of that in-state as we possibly can. And I think over time we will get better at that. Our facility can handle frozen and fresh product. We have a system for produce distribution that is just remarkable on how fast we can get that out to agencies. That has made a big, big difference in terms of being able to handle the produce. We'll move between 600 and 850,000 pounds of produce this next year. We would love to handle 1 million pounds a year.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Heyer is Executive Director for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This is the Farming World, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. Listening to the Farming World from Illinois Public Media. It's part of the Closing Market Report, speaking in which here are some of the numbers as they settle up, and we'll give you the weekly trade. This is the High and the Low in the Settlement. Usually you get it on Commodity Week. Our guest will be Terry Rogensack with Hightower. We'll record at 4:30 this afternoon. Posted to our website at willag.org by about 6 o'clock this evening. September wheat on the week settled 65 and a quarter cents higher. Week over week, $6.61.5. The settlement price, September corn at 392 and three quarters, up 21 and a half. December corn at 406 and three quarters, 22 and a quarter higher on the week. August beans were up 35 and a half cents for the week at $10.52.5, and the November's at $10.05, up 23 and a half cents on the week. August live cattle futures down 77 and a half at 92.65. The feeders at 113.72 and a half, down $1.45. And the lean hog futures an $85.82.5 settlement price. Week over week, a gain there of $2.60. Once again, we'll talk with Terry Rogensack. He's with the Hightower Report during the Commodity Week program, recorded at 4:30 this afternoon. We'll post it to our website at willag.org. That's willag.org by, well, just about 6 o'clock this evening.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Up next, bees and honey go together like bread and butter. But the bee has a huge role beyond producing something sweet, one that has huge implications for the backyard and commercial gardener alike. Lisa Brautz explores all things bees in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
My cucumbers have been a massive disappointment this garden season. The plants don't look all that healthy. There are way more male flowers than female flowers. And the female flowers, which supposedly bear the fruit, they're not. It could be this summer's heat. It could be a bad set of seeds. And I do admit to some benign neglect. But it could also be a lack of pollinators, specifically bees, in my part of the neighborhood. See, I need pollinators to come into my backyard and move pollen around from plant to plant, thus nudging my food-producing plants into, well, producing food. But actually, we all need pollinators to do their thing, because if they didn't, it would be a huge problem, agriculturally speaking. Bees have been on the decline for the past several decades for many reasons, but in 2006, the decline sped up. We started hearing about colony collapse disorder, a bizarre phenomenon where entire populations of adult bees would just disappear and die off for no apparent reason, leaving behind the hive's queen, unhatched bees, and food stores. This wasn't happening only in some far-off land either. This was, and still is, happening in the United States, wiping out entire colonies of bees in some states. Experts still don't really know what causes it. The appearance of colony collapse disorder shed new light on the practice of commercial beekeeping, of course, and how large-scale keeping of bees can affect large-scale agriculture. But it also dovetailed with the burgeoning interest nationally in local food, gardening, and related DIY projects. Robbie Nagel keeps bees in Urbana, where his friend J.P. Gogan lives, a large house backed up onto a few acres and a huge garden not far from downtown.
It goes along with a resurgence in local food systems and people saying that they want their own gardens. This is sort of the next step because honeybees and pollinators are so important for a lot of our food. So it goes along, people say, oh, I want a garden, I have a garden, that's great. And then people say, oh, okay, now my garden needs to be pollinated, and what can do that? Honeybees.
Robbie's grandfather kept bees for 30 years as a hobby. When he decided to get out of it, Robbie asked for all of his beekeeping equipment so he could learn how. Just like when I asked my grandmother to send me all of her old wooden knitting needles after she gave up knitting. Robbie's grandfather, like my grandmother, was happy to give him the tools he needed. In Robbie's case, those included hives and frames, a bee smoker, and some bee tools. He even gave Robbie a few bee suits and hats and veils. You have to wear this stuff if you want to deal with bees. And even then, there's no guarantee you won't get stung. Lately, I've been wondering if I should add a hive to my backyard situation, what with all my spare time and lack of cucumbers, so I decided to pay Robbie and JP a visit to see what it entails. After a short interview, Robbie invited me to suit up. I asked him to describe what that means.
Yeah, for us it means a full suit, head to toe, with a veil and gloves. And some beekeepers don't wear veils. I've seen that before. Some beekeepers don't wear gloves. I've seen that before. This is only my going on my second year, so I prefer the full suit and veil until I get more comfortable with it.
Right. I opted for the suit. It wasn't the best day to check on bees. It was hot and overcast, and there was a stiff breeze. JP, who takes care of the bees when Robbie's not around, was working the smoker. Smoking the bees in their hive disrupts their communication with each other and causes them to eat a bunch of honey, which calms them down. That allows the beekeepers to do their work, and in JP's case, forego the bee suit. Today, Robbie was pulling frames out of the hive to check for honey, and he was impressed with the results.
I put this honey super on 2 weeks ago. It was completely empty, just nothing on there, brand new. And,
oh, wow, it's already capped.
They've drawn it out. We call that snow white comb because it's brand new. The comb can get dirty as the bees walk on it more. And,
this is a great shot.
This looks really nice. I'm really surprised that they were able to do this in a couple of weeks.
I learned from Robbie and JP that keeping bees in a residential urban area is actually really good for the bees and good for making honey, thanks to the huge variety of plants that are grown by people in their gardens. Outside of town, where people grow lots and lots of one or two things, there isn't as much in the way of plant diversity for the bees. Bees can also be harmed by crop dusting in rural areas, so keeping them in town might be safer for them too. The one thing urban dwellers wanting to keep bees might have to reckon with, though, is neighbors. Fortunately, JP's neighbors and housemates are cool with it. Beekeeping culture is alive and well in Urbana-Champaign, too, with the Central Eastern Illinois Beekeepers Association around for assistance, education, and inspiration for bee geeks of all ages, even those who don't have their own bees. They can use this informal network to share equipment and advice and mentor each other, too. Maybe it's not the same as having a grandpa show you the ropes, but it helps. I might decide to go for it if I can clear it with my family and the neighbors. Yep, I've scoped out the perfect location for a hive in my backyard. Stay tuned.
Lisa Roth's stories can also be heard on our website, willang.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have an idea for an In My Backyard, email us at willagstaff@illinois.edu. or call us at 217-333-7300.